You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it is the 5th of May, 2021. Christ is risen. This is the Wednesday of Easter week. I know Lent, especially for new converts, can be very difficult, but if you were struggling in keeping the fasting rules, just always keep in mind that our life in 2021 is one long Lent. All of us are suffering. And as this kind of suffering brings us closer to God, it burns our sins away. It's one of the many positive things about living in this environment is that Lent never ends. And we're living in an unprecedented time. We're living in a period of suffering such that, you know, if you failed or didn't do very well in the formal fasting rules or abstinence rules, I should say, it's okay, really, because our lives are in nonstop suffering. I thank you for all the work you've done in assisting me. My listeners have made it possible for me to function full-time as a scholar and a writer and translator and everything else. I couldn't possibly be doing this without you. It's been the greatest surprise of my career that not only could I be an academic outside of academia, but that it would be my listeners and supporters, that would be the ones responsible for it. And I can't thank you enough. I really wish I could thank everyone individually, but I can't. But understand that I really truly appreciate it, especially in this day and age. I think part of the reason I have a strong support base is that I deal with things that no one else does. I'm approaching the world in a way that not only very few other people do, but many people, you know, take from me and go from there. Building a whole movement which didn't exist before, which is both frustrating and gratifying. And I want to continue that. I want to continue that today, despite the situation we're living in. Despite the circumstances that we're suffering through, understand that this can be a time of great personal growth. And before I forget, for a long time, I've been talking about my book on nominalism. And from the point of view of philosophy and metaphysics, this, I really see it as my, for lack of a better phrase, my magnum opus when it comes to philosophy. I kind of systematize the idea that nominalism in metaphysics is the cognitive cause of our situation. You can't have modernity without nominalism. And I mention this because I am now hard at work on this philosophical book. The working title right now is The Ontology of Death, Patristic Philosophy Against Promethean Nominalism. calling nominalism the ontology of death has been a trademark of mine for some time. And I'm not going to talk about that today, but as it stands now, God willing, I want this thing out and published by, at the latest, Thanksgiving. Now, I'm also looking for publishers. If there's anybody out there who knows a publisher on our side that can work with this, I want to branch out a little bit in that regard. Anyone knows anything about book publishers out there who would be interested in this, let me know. That would be a big deal. So essentially what the book is, it's to show that nominalism isn't just an error, it's also a heresy. And it's not just a heresy, it's the foundation of all heresies, especially in our age. Oftentimes people who go through the works of the Church Fathers aren't skilled in metaphysics. On the other hand, those people who know the metaphysical vocabulary aren't going through the Church Fathers. They're not taken as philosophers, despite the fact that they were first-rate philosophic minds. You know, they were theologians, they were psychiatrists, they were ethicists, they were political theorists, there were many things. St. Augustine was all of that and more. I want to treat these men as philosophers, and specifically as metaphysicians. You can't describe the nature of God's relation with humanity, the Council of Chalcedon, all the rest of it. You can't describe that at all without the metaphysics of Plato and Plotinus. It's simply not possible. And to reject the metaphysics of the forms collected in Logos as the center of everything, not the center of all, the center of reality, it is absolutely impossible. There's simply no way to be a Christian and accept nominalism as the foundation of reality. You can't talk about human nature and be a nominalist, because a nominalist rejects the idea of a nature of anything. Nothing makes any sense from the nominalist point of view. It is the root of our confusion. Oftentimes people will tell me that it's difficult to debate with our enemies, to fight with our enemies, because everything seems to be geared to their mentality. Even the very vocabulary that we use, the assumptions that we have going into any discussion with one of our enemies is already on. They always have home field advantage. You know, how do you argue against nominalism? How do you apply, you know, Plato and Plotinus and Gregory of Nyssa to the world of science, for example? What could that foundation be? The rejection of the individual object almost seems absurd when we're all born and raised with this positivist so-called scientific notion. So that's really the foundation of what this book is. And it goes through everyone. Well, and there's so many people I can go through. One of the greatest is Justin Martyr, who I've dealt with before, Hilary of Poitiers, St. Basil, who's often not treated as a philosopher, Saints Benedict and Romuald, the Western Orthodox monastic legislators, are never treated as having a metaphysical or an ontological status, but in fact, they do. Isaac of Syria, Maximus the Confessor, Cyril of Alexandria, and of course, Chalcedon, Dionysius, the Areopagite, and even St. Cyril of Turov, let alone Gregory of Palamas and Simeon the New Confessor. These guys were first-class metaphysicians and philosophers. They needed to understand the philosophical mind, the metaphysical mind, before they could even begin to talk about things like free will, or the relationship of the divine and human nature, what a nature even is. And they took a lot for granted, that the modern man doesn't understand. It's extremely difficult to go reading church fathers without knowing the vocabulary of Plato and Aristotle and Plotinus. It's almost impossible. They take that for granted, what they're referring to. It's just not a part of day-to-day experience in the Western modern mind. And it's a huge problem when you have people who don't understand this stuff opening up, you know, the church fathers for the first time outside of the very practical, you know, instructions, which of course are all worthwhile. And they're talking about deeper topics. They're hearkening back to a philosophical system that no longer exists. It's correct, but it doesn't exist in the public mind anymore. The heretic John Roman Didis has done a tremendous amount of damage, because this is the man who actually wanted to make nominalism at the heart of Orthodox theology. It's a monstrous, it's almost a chimera. It's like a Frankenstein monster of thinking, and he did a huge amount of damage. I used to read him quite often, and you know, I was expecting him at some point to resolve the contradictions that he was promoting, and in terms of this total lack of connection between God and man, which he actually says there is no connection between divine and human natures, largely by denying that these natures exist. Vladimir Moss did a very good job at a more practical level in tearing apart John Roman Didis' almost an anti-theology. I mean, paper after paper, he writes on experience and having experience be the core of the Christian life without telling me what this experience is or how I could tell a true one from a false one. He is a damaging persona intellectually in every other way. And it's connected with so-called name-worshipping concept, which I've dealt with before, and how that's been complete. One of the reasons that whole controversy is so twisted beyond belief is that the metaphysical vocabulary needed to understand these things is not a part of even the educated public mind. With the church fathers, you have to, you know, understand Plato and Plotinus first, understand what those terms mean, not to mention the entire philosophic schema that was dominant at the time, especially in the Greek language. And then things start to make sense. And of course, you know, we live in, you know, 2021, where, you know, Plato is butchered everywhere you go. The modern mind can't make any sense of the doctrine of the forms, the doctrine of logos. You know, we're raised in the world of John Locke, where the external world is completely dead, undifferentiated matter that the mind, really the elite mind, then goes and produces things out of, and only then, only through production, does anything exist. And with those things that are created, we then give a name to them. Of course, John Locke was the modern promoter of this ideology, and it's still the dominant way of thinking today. And so that's why this book is absolutely, absolutely essential. And it is something specifically that I have that I've offered both I do not claim to be a theologian. That would be, I understand theology from a philosophical lens. Very few of us can claim to be a theologian in the true sense of the word. I'm not talking about the intellectual apprehension of church matters or grace or forgiveness. That's, you know, we understand that from a philosophical point of view, but not from a theological point of view. That already implies a closeness between logos and the theologian that not a whole lot of people have. Very few saints are called theologian. You know, John and Gregory Simeon the New Theologian, as I mentioned. And that's a title that suggests a closeness to God that, well, most of us, myself included, simply don't have. So in dealing with nominalism, you're dealing with the entire foundation of the modern mentality. And even that is falling apart. I use this word quite often. I briefly want to mention what I'm talking about. Over the centuries, there's been numerous definitions of this doctrine. Nominalism, of course, comes from the Latin word for name. And the doctrine, at its most basic, says that universal entities don't exist. The only thing that's actually real are individual entities. In other words, there's no such thing as goodness. Goodness as a universal concept that gets instantiated in individual good acts doesn't exist. Rather, individual good acts exist. Then humanity, over time, groups them into different types, calls it good, and that becomes goodness. There is no goodness, of course. It's just these individual acts that are either pleasurable or useful, profitable, and we collect them all and give them a word, good. That is the core of what nominalism is. Universal entities, whether it be, you know, good or evil, truth, reason, mind, or even species of animals and plants. These don't exist. These are entirely in the human mind. They're creations. So when we're talking about a good act, these are approximations. There is no good. But a good act is something that makes us feel a certain way. That's pleasurable or profitable, whatever. And over time, we just use the word good as an abbreviation, a simple label that, generally speaking, collects all of those things and gives them a general name. That's all it is a name, hence nominalism. John Locke, of course, at the beginning of the Enlightenment, is one of the dominant political theorists of our world. It's even said that he was one of the main influences behind the U.S. Constitution, which he was not. Russell Kirk put an end to that myth. All the writings of the founding fathers at the time, Locke is not hardly mentioned at all. He doesn't come up. Their examples were Greco-Roman. It's simply not the case. Prior to him, of course, it's William of Ockham, Franciscan, in Britain, who eliminated the whole concept of an essence of something. There is no such thing as human nature. Human nature is just, again, or any nature. Nature, essence, form, all the same thing. There is no human nature. We just kind of, everything that looks and acts like a human being, we kind of consider human. It really is the system, when you consider it like that, is actually pretty bizarre. It's based, of course, on basic empiricism, where we come to know things by collecting data. And these data points have certain things in common, and that's how we group things. I mean, it's highly simplistic, but that's the basic theory. Realism, with a capital R, is the opposite. The idea that universal entities come first. A unity has to exist before there could be multiplicities. Good exists whether or not there's any good acts in the world at all. Human nature is a specific universal concept. A universal entity is not physical. It's spiritual. It exists outside of space and time. So nominalism being the official ideology of the Western world since the Renaissance, since Thomas Hobbes, since the Renaissance came to an end, despite some substantial resistance, of course, is a completely secular, if not an atheistic ideology. The problem is, if no universal entities exist, then there could be no concept of a divine nature. Or if there is, as William Faulkner would say, he simply isn't knowable. He's completely separate from the human experience. All we know is individual objects. Therefore, something like God is not an object among others. He remains something we have to take entirely on faith. There is no law, unless this thing is natural law or divine law. In the nominalist mind, that's a universal. Certain things are true regardless of time and place. Aspects of human nature, for example, nominalists can't accept that. Law is not something that's uncovered. Law is something that's created by a legislator. And it's law because some powerful people say it's law. We follow God's commands because God has commanded them, not because I have any intrinsic virtue. And you still come across certain Protestants that, of course, their whole Protestantism is based, really prefaced, the individual, reading the words of the Bible. And there is nothing more than that. Nominalism has its rebirth at the end of the Middle Ages, from the 14th century to the rise of the Reformation. And the decay, the disease, began to corrode the pillars of medieval society. Something is a law because powerful people say it's a law. You can't even talk about any intrinsic goodness or justice because there is no such thing. It's something that the state will create. And therefore, you follow it, because allegedly it's supposed to be representative of the population. And it's simply taken for granted. The opposite, of course, is realism, where there is natural law, an aspect of God's power and God's presence on earth that never changes. Therefore, it's not physical. It's eternal. It's beyond space and time. And it's only those entities that could ever be the source of knowledge. We talk about the problems in modern science. Science, of course, is regime-funded, corporate-funded, with official ideologies that are imposed on students in school. That's the nature of their truth. Their truth comes from the fact that there's this scholarly consensus on it. As Karl Popper and others would say, positivism is the scientific analog to all of this. It's very difficult to maintain that consistently. It's very difficult to even speak without accepting the idea of a universal. Even someone like, Charles Darwin, I mentioned before, there is no species. Despite the title of the book, a species doesn't exist because it comes to be, it passes away. It changes. There are no permanent species. As the whole concept of evolution is saying, there's no permanent species. For a whole lot of reasons, it's ridiculously unscientific. And it reduces, this has been the case for a long time, it reduces science to studying things that the scientific mind created in the first place. Not only are there no universal things, but even the idea of the particular starts to break down. Russian philosophers have done very well in this respect. Even something like free will, a nominalist cannot talk about the human will. They have to talk about specific uses of that. Then we'll talk about the will as just an abbreviation. No one's ever seen a will before. like David Hume, no one's ever seen a cause before. And of course, the great, the founder of that, so to speak, is Plato. Realism, natural law, truth beyond space and time comes from Plato's work. For me personally, I became a Christian after reading Plato's Republic for the first time. I had never heard of these essentially supernatural entities being defended intellectually before. Like so many of us, we're raised with the idea that religion is something that's based on blind faith. For a nominalist, you have no choice. There's only individual things. We're going to talk about, you know, God and grace and logos. They're not individual things. Grace is this universal power. Referring to it as an individual thing is ridiculous, but that's the only source that they have to draw from. Therefore, everything is based on power, and you believe it because you have to believe it. There is no connection between God and man, as the forms and logos would be. And if you reject that, God is this alien force, like Allah, that imposes himself on you, and the church simply is that entity that legislates what you're supposed to believe. You either accept it or you don't, but there's no rational reason to accept it. So nominalism is this corrosive, evil system. And I know of no one who systematized this, that nominalism is the ontology of decay and destruction. Now, this book should be done, like I say, I want the latest to be Thanksgiving. Thereabouts, maybe December. I've been inspired recently to do this. I'm going to be spending the summer on it. I've had a few broadcast lectures on pieces of this book in the past. The one on Gregory of Nyssa a few months ago. A few others that kind of touched on a few topics here. But this is, and ultimately really it comes down to how we behave, our understanding. We believe a certain set of things, and that, over time at least, influences our behavior. So, in the patristic mind, from a philosophical point of view, a virtue is a habit or a set of habits that then allow the mind to ascend, as we would call the ladder, from individual objects, things around us, these brute givens, to then objects bearing the universal reality instantiated in the object. The individual object provokes and manipulates the passions. Nominalism is not about the intellect. You're talking about a specific thing, which then an actual physical object in front of you, which does not provoke the reason, it provokes the passions. I know I've used this example before, but no one has ever desired the theoretical concept of a woman. No, you only desire a specific woman in front of your face right now. It's only the individual that provokes the passions. You could analyze the most beautiful woman in geometric and anatomical theory, and none of that will provoke your desire. Only the brute object will do it. Again, one of the reasons that nominalism is so dominant and so deeply ingrained. But to rise above that, not so much that you deny the existence of the individual, heaven knows, but that the individual is beautiful or good to the extent that it manifests the universal truth within it. So we move from a life where objects manipulate the passions to a life where God is observed working through natural objects. and according to laws governing their interaction. You can't believe in any natural laws and be a nominalist or a positivist. That mentality shows the natural order, things external to us. They're not truth, it's only violence. And of course, the vice does the very opposite of this. Virtues and vices have to do with our understanding, and our understanding has to do with the objective structure of the world. For a nominalist, there can be no objective structure of the world. It's something that we put together because it's useful to us. So a virtue is a structure of behavior, like almost a rule of life, that permits us to ascend to God in the sense of seeing the universal in the particular thing, the spirit that's hidden under the colors and sounds of the natural world. Natural law, the laws discoverable by science, is seen by the mystic or ascetic as the loving presence of God directing his creation. For the vulgar, for the nominalist, for the positivist, law, whether civil or natural, is only a form of violence. It's a form of coercion. It's a form of death. Law is something that's set over us, oppressing us, something with its own set of obligations and penalties. You know, the Protestant idea that, you know, being a Christian is following these rules, and really, you know, all it comes down to, you know, Calvin's Geneva. You know, the salvation by grace removes works from anything, which removes culture, removes all of that. But it still lays out a rule of life. And if you follow it, you get rewarded. Laws are always something that's set over us. It oppresses us. And if you follow those laws, you get rewarded. If you don't, you get punished. So St. Gregory of Sinai says, fire, darkness, worm, hell correspond to passions, lusts of all kinds, the all-embracing darkness of ignorance, the unquenchable thirst for sensual pleasures, the stench of evil-smelling sin, which, like precursors and foretastes of the torment of hell, even now begin to torture sinners in whose souls they take root through long-established habit. Well, the other word for habit is vice. Both virtues and vices are habits. They're modes of acting that sometimes we don't even have to think about. It just becomes a part of our personality. We're always going to commit individual acts opposed to our nature. That happens quite often. But that's not really who we are. Virtues and vices are who we are, how we function, even if we're not paying attention. So good acts, virtuous acts, are those that permit the ascent to Logos. Logos, the collection of all the forms and universals, which then is the divine nature, the second person of the Trinity. So this permits the ascent to Christ, the ability to view nature this way. This is a sum total of the ascetic struggle, what we've just been through during Lent. So even in our worst circumstances, we see God's presence. This isn't happening by accident. It's not just random chance. God is present here, bringing something good about. So a bad act, an evil act, brings man back to the prison. It brings man to the worship of earthly power. Those are the two options. Realism and nominalism and all their various guises represent these two approaches. A passion, we use the word passion quite often. It's the pull that objects within fallen nature have on our human will. They draw us in. They almost force the will to act one way over another, to be drawn in one direction, to be repelled in another direction. Attributes of natural objects. That mentality has us viewing them purely as a means whereby a certain drive can be temporarily satisfied. But this is how the Enlightenment, the modern man and follower of Locke and Thomas Hobbes before him, how the unredeemed view created nature. It's an arena. It's a field where the drives can either be supported or not supported, satiated or not satiated. But amounting to the same thing, it's also an arena for those with the ability to set their passions above others for a fee, then dominate the world. This nominalist universe, if you even use the word universe, means that those with the power to do this, understanding what the human passions are, and controlling the world as they do, can dangle that in front of us for a fee and make a huge amount of money. E. Michael Jones has spent his career on this. The sexual revolution made the huge mistake of releasing the male sex drive, that genie from that bottle, which I don't think could be put back again. What ended up happening with those who were able to control media can offer to satiate that, of course, for a fee. And people have made a killing of, there's no field out there that hasn't used this sex drive, advertising especially, to draw people in a completely irrational way to do things that they normally wouldn't. The opposite of that is what we're talking about here. The repetition of good actions are those that, in their totality, raise the human being out of that prison into the light of the Trinitarian life that we were created for. And the word light is also a metaphysical term. It doesn't just mean light in the sense we use it. So a word like freedom, if we define this properly, it's the liberation of the will from the prison of cause and effect. Nature in its lowest form. Science, the way we normally use the term, has no right to talk about anything that is not based on cause and effect. So the opposite, repetition of bad acts, imprisons you into the earthly world of cause and effect. Good actions, repeated over time, create this habit of life doing the opposite. This is what we're judged on. This becomes our personality. This becomes who we are. Of course, we're going to deviate from it. That's not even an issue. That doesn't mean that's who we are. This also means the concept of sin is different from the Protestant mentality. These aren't individual acts. Sin is the mentality from which these acts derive. Viewing the world in an erroneous way produces irrational acts. But sin also doesn't offend God in the normal sense of the term. It offends against the dignity of our people. Sin is a gradual effacing of the true destiny of man. Sin drives us deeper into the prison where the drives of the will are the only reality, ultimately dissolving entirely. And objects in space are the means whereby these are satisfied, however, temporarily. Sin is a prison. It imprisons man in the world of cause and effect, of force and coercion. But also, it imprisons you at the mercy of those who control that power, that kind of coercion. That also means that penance isn't making something up to God. You're not compensating him for something. Rather, it's putting the Orthodox man on the right path. The concept of asceticism and self-denial isn't just rule-following. Not just denying yourself something because it's painful. It's breaking your dependence on the life of cause and effect. You train the will not to seek fulfillment in this world of violence and coercion, but in the liberation that only the universal truth can provide. St. Macarius the Great says this: after a person had turned away from God's commandments and became subject to his condemnation, sin had enslaved him, and like a narrow and deep abyss of bitterness, having pervaded inside, captured the soul to its very deepest recesses. Likewise, we can compare the sin within us as a large and leafy tree whose roots stretch deep into the soil. Thus, having entered our soul, sin had overwhelmed it to the deepest recesses, becoming a habit that begins in our childhood and with the years grows ever stronger, and it leads us towards the vile. So this is the basis of asceticism, to reject living in that world. Asceticism liberates the will. It brings it to above the world of cause and effect, into the world of universal truth and reality, that of spirit. Objects reflecting the will and love of the Creator, rather than a means to temporarily fulfill your own personal will. Objects as individual things are not abandoned, but they're radically transformed. Once you see Logos present in the natural order, you begin to see a glimpse of the fullness of their being. This is the concept of transfiguration. You hear at all the feasts, the church, and all the verses that we say in Matins and Vespers, they use language that is almost bizarre to the modern mind. Did Christ actually create a new earth after his resurrection? Has he destroyed sin? Well, we sin every day. What does that mean? I don't see a new earth anywhere. So what is that kind of language talking about? What it means is, again, on a purely philosophical level, that God has provided those who believe in him to receive the light, a light that would reveal the fullness of created nature, to reveal its universality. For once we're on the path, the earth then becomes truly a new creation. In the church, Eden has been restored. We could experience that tomorrow, but our sins and hang-ups keep us from comprehending it. And this is often not entirely your fault. You're born and raised into this demented system. It's a huge amount of work to even begin to see the outlines of what that would be like. And you see this in the lives of the saints. Saints see visions. They're able to attract wild animals. They predict the future. They actually can see inside of a person. And all of this comes from the ascetic life. This is what happens when you release yourself from the world of cause and effect, and your perception then becomes heightened. You're not seeing individual things anymore. This is a life where the dead weight of objects are transfigured into the life of the universal, the form, the mind of God. So it doesn't matter where you look, from medieval Ireland to Palestine to Egypt to Russia. Life of the ascetic saint is basically the same. He's perceiving more than we do. Human perception picks up a minuscule percentage of what is out there. No one denies that. The most secular science will tell you that. The sound spectrum. Overwhelming, we don't hear any of it. We hear a tiny percentage of it. The light spectrum. What if our perception were increased? The use of our brain, what if this were all to gradually increase? What would we be perceiving? The ascetic life is the beginning of this. We'll begin perceiving God's presence. Natural law isn't alien from things, it's within things. That's what Logos is. We can see the outlines of the universal within particular objects. The universal nature of things. Things are seen by the mind rather than the senses. Now, of course, the ancients were only able to reach so far into this world without grace, of course. Only the most gifted of metaphysicians could ever even begin to see this, you know, the outlines of reality. And the church, of course, or the simplest of monks could understand this. And only the later ascetics could provide the content of what was a purely formal world in Plato. Plato will talk about the forms of things, archetypes, not talking about what might be within those. The church is able to show us the outline of that. It's what it means to be enlightened. Though for Plato, he can only see the form of something, the universal truth of something, as an empty unit of the intellect. But he certainly saw it. For us, though, God's given us the gift. We give our labors a living sacrifice. Metaphysics is a function of our own labor. It's not merely a dry and irrelevant aspect of university life. So salvation is based on good works in the sense that such good works create virtue, or a disposition of the will, where objects in their lowest form as brute givens are replaced by a desire to see them in their fullness. I know I've said this 100 times before, but this is a philosophical key to everything that we're supposed to be doing. Once we see this, we actually begin to partake in divinity. This isn't just verbiage here, and it sounds like verbiage to the modern mind. This is what it means. But this divinity, this light, the truth, has always been present since we've been baptized. But seeing it is extremely difficult. The fullness of the grace of the Spirit has always been there. It's just that our lives and our environment doesn't permit us to be able to perceive it, understand or even live according to it. That takes place only within the ascetic life of the church. It's only here that the Spirit operates. And as things get worse and worse around us, the chances of us seeing anything, I mean, we're not seeing visions here. Like the saints, and if we did, we need to reject them right away. Because we're in no position to see visions. That world of the ascetic life simply doesn't exist, unfortunately. Or if it exists, you have people living in a cave in Athos, maybe. No, we need to be, we can't be expecting anything like that. We're not in that position, and I don't think we ever will be. We understand the church as, so to speak, the incarnation of the Spirit. Now, I don't mean it's literally the incarnation of the Spirit, but that's really what it is in practical terms. And that its members, we partake in the Trinitarian life by virtue of the struggle. And this is why we say the church is not merely a human institution, but that salvation is available only to the ascetic strugglers. So virtue permits the light of the Spirit to penetrate us completely. So sin does the opposite. It renders us brute and obtuse, material and vulgar, caring only about, you know, our next meal or how animals operate. So, for example, if we were to be baptized, and if we didn't sin, in any sense of the term, after our initiation, we would be so saturated with grace, we couldn't contain it. We could foretell the future, see the angels and saints on a daily basis, tame the most violent beasts, and would be absolutely happy. Space and time would cease to exist. We would live in the rapture of grace. But that's not how it is. That's what all of the prayers and the services and these great feasts keep referring to, this new world. Though it certainly exists, but we can't live there. And we can't live there because we sin. We can't live there because we are born and raised in saturated in evil. We choose a nominal entity, the brute object, as a means of satisfying a certain passion. You know, I've used this example before, and I'm going to use it again. This has come up where a young man, for example, has to navigate this demented world. And it's something along the lines of, you know, we're raised in this completely vulgar, sexualized media universe. We're raised in it since we were toddlers. We grow into adulthood essentially as alcoholics who are forced to work at a bar. And not just that, but we see people around us having a great time, drinking and do whatever they want. It appears to us like there's nothing bad can happen to them. And not just that, we have people coming up to us with drinks in their hands saying, oh, don't worry about it. You're not really, alcoholism doesn't really exist. That's all in your head. Come on, join us. And whole ideologies, you see it on the TV set in the bar, all these ideologies saying it's okay, it's all in your mind. All that stuff is nonsense. Come join us. You're alcoholics to begin with. Working at a bar because you have no other choice, surrounded by people drinking, having the best possible time, offering you alcohol, you're surrounded by it, and telling you that the reason you don't drink is all in your head. You should come enjoy it. That's what a young man's life is in high school, college, or anywhere that's not in a cave on Athos. And, of course, we're going to take that drink all the time. I certainly have, and most of you certainly have. Now, you are not going to burn for eternity for this. You know the integrity as a Christian man is not changed by these temporary lapses. But you know, once you sober up the next day and you feel like crap, you have to go back to work at the bar. But now you're not going to do it again. You've suffered now. Who knows what you did when you were drinking? Maybe you got into a fight. You're all hungover. Doesn't seem so great now. But then, after a few days, it all happens again. The point is, the church is this alternative. Yeah, you still have to work in the bar, but at least now you have a bit of a support structure. But that's how it is for us living in the world. I mentioned last week, a couple weeks ago, having some of the, take St. John the Faster and make him go to an American university for a month. What is he going to do? You know, the rationality and the justice of older societies no longer exists. We're all alcoholics, forced to work in a bar, surrounded by people who are having a great time. How do you compete with that? I mean, if you're a missionary, you're coming in and you're his, your AA sponsor, how do you tell him that this is, that's not the way to go? You're surrounding you. Everyone's having a great time. How come I can't? You start getting depressed. How come I can't be like that? You start having the AA in contempt. You're keeping me from having this good time. This is how it goes. Very few young men out there will disagree with me in this regard. But God's strength is made perfect in weakness. Of course we're going to fall. It's absurd to think we're not going to fall. But knowing that circumstance, let's say you're a father and your son is in that circumstance, and he falls, what would you do? You punch him in the face? Of course not. We all understand. We live in, surrounded by such sickness and death, but sickness that's dressed up in such a way that we almost resent not being able to partake in it. This is universal phenomenon. And there's other things too. Money, wealth, social standing and status, giving into anger. Understand, though, that all of these temptations are based on a fantasy. You don't know if they're having a good time or not. You have no clue. It looks that way to you, especially if you really want to take a drink. And that's the world that we live in. So we're going to sin. We choose the nominal entity, the brute object, because we think it's going to satisfy a certain passion. We remain in God's grace. We get back up again, understanding the damage that it's done, and we steel ourselves to try to avoid it again. But you keep doing it, and it becomes a habit, it becomes a vice. That's when God is absent. Asceticism, suffering orthodoxy, as Archbishop Ivorki put it, is a means whereby we are raised above this world. We're shown the basis of its creation, the life of the forms, as they exist in God, rather than in our perception. Our perception is retarded by sin, the world, and the fall. And people coming up to us saying, oh, take a drink, alcoholism is just in your head. So the extent to which the penitent, the sufferer, is prepared to receive the light of Christ on earth, that's our lot after our repose. There's not a big difference between our life prior to death and after death. you can receive the light in this world, receive the light after this world. Orthodox people at their chrismation and baptism receive the Holy Spirit. We're tricomposite, as John of Damascus says, body, soul, and spirit. The unredeemed man is bicomposite. He just has the body and soul. The soul that is not saved, that is not filled with grace, is a machine. It's a machine that produces methods and means whereby passions are satisfied, and nothing more. And we all know, you take a drink and get drunk with people, it's not going to satisfy a damn thing. You're going to be right back and having the same problem a day or two later. But that life doesn't partake of the spirit. That is the life of a machine. It's a fallen entity. The soul that in and of itself doesn't recognize the spirit. It doesn't. It does very little else. That is the importance of this book on nominalism. Understanding the intellectual foundations of the cognitive death that we're surrounded by every single day. E. Michael Jones, though he's not a philosopher, has a great introduction to the concept of logos in his Logos Rising. But the concept of logos is essential. It is a synthesis of all archetypes, while at the same time a collection of them. The archetypes are forms. They're things. They're created things. But they're spiritual, eternal things. Taken together, they comprise logos. All in creation. This logos is manifest in nature. And that is the doctrine of the mystic experience of the church. Logos is how God is present in our lives. The Spirit communicates that to us as individuals. So logos contains the forms. The Spirit communicates that to us in our specific situation. We live in an age of suffering. That is not going to change anytime soon. We live in an age where these kind of scenarios, the worship of the individual, physical thing, based on some fantasy that it's going to satisfy something, the foundation of our suffering right now. The Hesychasts, at least in terms of their understanding of the world's ontology, imply that this light, this form, is found in logos. It's virtually limitless how it can be understood both relative to metaphysics and the spiritual life. Form, archetype, light, these are essentially synonymous. Let me leave you with a line from Gregory Palamas. Through the fall, our nature was stripped of divine illumination and resplendence, but the Logos of God had pity on our disfigurement, and in his compassion, he took our nature upon himself, and on Tabor he manifested it to his elect disciples, clothed once again most brilliantly. He shows what we once were, what we shall become through him in the age to come, if we choose to live our present life as far as possible in accordance with his ways. We're not separated from God. God doesn't exist in some autonomous sphere of life, or that we exist in some autonomous sphere of earthly life, something separate from heaven and the light. We're ontologically different from those who are not redeemed. So long as the struggle is maintained, none of us will ever be pure. The phenomenal man, the man that exists in the day-to-day world, we are saturated in sin. But our integrity, the noumenal self, our belief system, our sense of self, that can be perfect. That can be spotless. And that is what we present to God. There is a distinction, a primary ontological distinction between the baptized and that of the unredeemed. So that's because we can be raised above the fallen world of nature. Nature as blind force. Nature in its lowest form. By nominalism, the belief that only individual things exist, they can't rise above this. They don't even have the language. They don't understand the concept of what it is to rise above it. But thanks to logos, thanks to the resurrection, which we celebrate this week, we're given this opportunity And so much of the victory is actually in the struggle itself. You're baptized, grace is ever present. The ascetic life makes us able to receive it or even understand it. The ascetic life permits us over time to see God within the natural world around us, to see his activity in the outside world. It is not blind forth. It is not random chance. It is the habitation of Logos. And as our society decays in the most violent and vomitious kind of a way, to the point we can't even describe it anymore, it seems that Logos lives in a totally different sphere from the cause and effect. That doesn't mean he isn't present. God isn't up in the sky somewhere. He exists in a dimension of reality, immanent in creation. Only our sins and passions obscure his presence. The unredeemed see creation as just blind force to be manipulated by corporations and science. The ascetic sees God's power. This is the essence of Orthodox ontology, and it radically separates it from what the bourgeoisie think Christianity actually is. So I will let you guys know about the progress of the ontology of death. And I hope to God that none of us fall into it anymore. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.